Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa School of Social Work, offering the opportunity to earn a master's degree from anywhere in Iowa, including an all-online MSW program. Information at socialwork.uiowa.edu.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, we'll meet a man who is turning some of the downed trees of eastern Iowa into artwork. But first, Iowa is facing some serious challenges. Challenges that threaten our way of life. Climate change, poor water quality, and a lack of young people. In his book, Green, Fair, and Prosperous, Paths to a Sustainable Iowa, Charles Connerly helps us understand how we've gotten to this point, and he shares his ideas for how we can chart a course for a brighter, healthier, and more diverse future. Connerly is a professor and director of the University of Iowa School of Urban and Regional Planning, and he is on the line with me now. Hello, Chuck.
Good morning, Charity. How are you today?
I'm good. Welcome back to the show.
It's good to be back. Thank you, even though I'm at home.
And, well, most of us are. In your book, you spend a lot of time writing about Iowa history, helping us understand how we've gotten to the point where we are right now. Why was that an important part of writing this book for you?
Well, part of it's personal. I have degrees in urban and regional planning, but I also have 2 degrees in history, and I write history of urban planning, but the reason why I write the history of urban planning or the history of planning and public policy is that I believe the historical perspective is really important. As an example, the chapter that is titled "Why Is Iowa So White?" I think it's necessary to take an historical perspective to figure out how we got where we are and how we've evolved over time. And that really needs to, it obviously requires going back to the initial occupation of the state by Native Americans and how ceased to be as Europeans or people of European descent began to move into Iowa in the 1830s.
The challenges that we're facing today, and we'll dig into to each one of the challenges that you write about more deeply, we spend a lot of time talking about them. We talk about water quality a lot. We talk about climate change. We talk about the fact that we have a graying population in Iowa. What was it that prompted you to write about this at this moment? Do you feel like Iowa is at a crossroads?
Well, I do, and I was an undergraduate at Grinnell in the 1960s, and then I had the opportunity to come back here in 2008, 6 weeks after the flood, and we had a student group doing a project about climate and conservation, and they had a slide. In fact, I just saw it recently. It was titled "Iowa at the Crossroads," and I thought that was just a good, really good metaphor. Now, clearly, it's not original. I mean, it's been used in other spaces before, but it just seemed to me that with the confluence of the changing economy of the state, clearly the environmental issues that you spelled out in brief at the beginning of the show, and the increased amount of concern as the state diversifies its population in terms of social justice and equity, that it was time to write a book like this. I was very conscious of the the classic sort of historical texts that have been written, the histories of Iowa. And the most recent one, I think, is Dorothy Schweider's book from the early 1990s, and several others as well. And they don't, because they're at least 30 years old, they don't really cover a lot of the issues. So I view this as in part as an adjunct to the existing historical literature, particularly on these topics that hadn't been covered very well.
You first set out to write this book in 2015, and you suffered a very serious health crisis. I hope you're doing much better now. I think you are, right?
I am. Yes, good. I am much better. Thanks to the good doctors at both of our hospitals.
You felt like Iowa was at a crossroads in 2015 when you started this process. How has your view changed in the last 5 years?
Well, at that particular moment in time, I was particularly struck by the debate and the discussion over water quality that was that came to my attention. At least it wasn't initiated by, but came to my attention by the lawsuit, the Des Moines Water Works lawsuit, where they sued the three counties in north central Iowa with regard to the use of drainage channels, pipes to channel water that they said was full, had a high concentration of nitrates, thereby forcing the waterworks to use rather expensive machinery to clean the nitrates out of the water so they could meet the federal drinking water standard. So that was a particular crisis that occurred at that time. But as you begin to search around and look around, clearly there were other things. With the election of 2016, the issues of immigration, which were there before, become sharper and sharper, and they remain sharp to this day. And then just looking at the state's economy over time, particularly it's in manufacturing, the two key meat manufacturing industries have been meatpacking and farm implement manufacturing, and both of those have gone under undergone major changes in their labor force, the wages they pay, the level of unionization, and so unions and unionization and the protections they provide for workers, which clearly isn't a value that I hold, seemed to me to be an important part of the story, and that needed to be told as well.
Well, let's dig into some of the different factors that you write about. And I want to start with agriculture because it's such an important part of our state today. It is such an important part of our state's history. And you write quite a bit about how our farms in Iowa changed through the farm crisis and really lay out some of the long-lasting changes that we're still dealing with today. When we talk about family farms in Iowa or a lack of family farms in Iowa, people push back on that all the time. But you can show how the mid-sized farm or the smaller farm was really lost through the farm crisis. Farms have gotten bigger and bigger with now less opportunity for those mid-range farmers, right?
Right. This is an historical trend that was taking place even before the farm crisis, but it certainly seems to have been exacerbated by the farm crisis. You know, we have we still are a state of family farms. And I think that you sort of indicated that when you said that. But they are much bigger. There are many fewer. This sounds strange to say, but there are many fewer farms than there were formerly.
Less farmland, but fewer farms.
Not less farmland.
Right.
Yeah, but fewer farms. And so, we're still primarily an agricultural state in that respect, but the farms have gotten huge and huge. And so many people have had to, in a sense, to bail out of the industry. I happen to live in an area where there are a lot of small family farms, but that's because the people who control those farms are Amish, they have small farms and they are unable to keep them, and large farms are not part of their culture. But by and large, certainly since the 1970s, certainly since Department of Agriculture began to really push production in the 1970s, either get big or get out. It was the mantra that was pushed by the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and it certainly has proven to be the case. And the farm crisis obviously hurt a lot of particularly either small farmers or farmers that had borrowed money or bought too much in the way of implements, and they got forced out. And other farmers were, in a sense, able to take advantage of that situation and buy low. This is what happens, as we know, in economic crises. Some people lose out, but other people are winners. And so there are farms, and I think I mentioned one in the book where they grew. A family farm that grew and grew and grew, beginning in the early to mid 1980s, as a direct result of the farm crisis.
So we have some winners, but far more losers through the farm crisis, and then less opportunity for the young people who hope to take over those farms or maybe own their own farm.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. It's you know, it's very expensive, you know, in terms of production farming, which is what we have, row crops, corn and soybeans, or even CAFOs. It's a very expensive, and so it's very difficult for people to get into that business. And so as a land of opportunity, as a state of opportunity, agriculture is not really that great of an opportunity for people, particularly people who've been shut out. Somebody asked me recently how many black-owned farms there are in Iowa, and I don't know that for a number. But I do know, I looked at the 2017 census, and there are only two counties in the state of Iowa, and I can't name them, but I think they're both in eastern, one's in eastern, one's in central Iowa, that have any black-owned farms at all. So it's not been a place of opportunity for African Americans, and I don't believe it's been an opportunity for other populations that have been moving into Iowa.
Well, and many people have come to this state from places around the world where they have a farming background. That's something that we've explored on this show. But the opportunities for immigrants or refugees to come to this state and practice their career to be a farmer, that is almost impossible for many of them. And there are a few organizations doing some terrific work to give them those opportunities. But you talk about black-owned farms, Asian-owned farms, or Latino-owned farms are also lacking in this state. And we are going to have to take a short break. Chuck, we'll be back in just a few minutes. We'll talk more about agriculture. We'll talk about manufacturing. We'll talk about environmental challenges here in the state and the racial history of Iowa. We'll also talk about the urban and rural divide in our state. You can join our conversation 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at Iowa Public Radio. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. My guest is Charles Connerly. His book is Green, Fair, and Prosperous: Paths to a Sustainable Iowa. He is professor and director of the University of Iowa School of Urban and Regional Planning. And coming up in just about 15 minutes, we'll meet a chainsaw carver who has been very, very busy since the derecho. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the University of Iowa School of Social Work, offering the opportunity to earn a master's degree from anywhere in Iowa, including an all-online MSW program. Information at socialwork.uiowa.edu.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest right now is Charles Connerly. He's the author of the new book, Green, Fair, and Prosperous: Paths to a Sustainable Iowa. He's also professor and director of the University of Iowa School of Urban and Regional Planning. And his book is about Iowa history, but it's also about the challenges that Iowa is facing in this moment and his ideas for how our state can move forward to a brighter, healthier, more sustainable, and more diverse future. You're welcome to join the conversation, 866-780-9100. And before we move on from agriculture, Chuck, Tim pointed out that there is less farmland in the state because suburban sprawl is eating it up. And we're not going to spend a lot of time exploring that, but I do want to correct what I said earlier, because yes, we have had a net loss of farmland, but we were talking, and the point remains that farms that continued to survive and thrive got much, much bigger through the farm crisis for the most part. I want to talk a little bit about manufacturing now. You mentioned meatpacking and manufacturing briefly as we were heading into the break. And of course, manufacturing, especially of farm implements, has been a huge part of the Iowa economy for a long time. And opportunities for middle-class Iowans in that field have also dwindled. Tell me more about that.
Right. The two industries took a different tack: farm machinery and meat packing. In the case of farm machinery, there obviously it was very important to the state. You know, a lot of manufacturing took place either in Iowa itself or across the river in the Quad Cities. But many of those people that worked across the river were Iowa residents. But there, the story has been, particularly with the shakeout in the industry with elimination of companies that took place during the farm crisis as well. Such as International Harvester. It's now J.I. Case, I think, J.I. I.H. Case, I think. Anyhow, John Deere became really the dominant employer in the state, not the sole, but the dominant employer. And they have been really adept at using technology and using automation. And so if you look at the number of people working in their major plants in the state of Iowa and compare it to where it was in the 1970s or early 1980s, the numbers of employees at John Deere are much smaller than they once were. So those workers are still well compensated. They are still represented by the United Auto Workers, but there are just fewer of them. And in the case of meatpacking, the strategy was to bust the unions again in the 1980s at the same time as the farm crisis was going on, to bust the unions and basically to replace many of the employees that worked at those plants with immigrants from many Latinx, but later immigrants from other countries as well, replace them, replace the people that were working there originally with immigrants from other places and other states, and break the union and not pay the new workers as well as they had paid the former workers. And so you have the jobs just simply aren't, they don't pay as well. And of course, the degree to which the unions, which are still there, can adequately represent those workers, particularly in a health crisis like with COVID, has been severely diminished.
You also write a great deal about the environmental challenges that the state is facing. And I mentioned both climate change and water quality, and you mentioned those as well. And I think a lot of people see our way of life at odds with battling climate change or mitigating climate change or our water quality problems as well. And you do write about a major success in Iowa, which has been embracing wind energy, which does combat climate change.
Well, absolutely. I mean, we are a success story when it comes to wind energy, you know, compared to where we were 20 years ago. I think particularly Mid-America has really picked up on that. I know in Iowa City is able to chart its success. The city of Iowa City is able to chart its success in meeting its climate goals in great part because of the switch from non-renewables to renewables of Mid-America. But this state uses a lot of energy, and if you look and creates a lot of greenhouse gases. And if you look, I've looked at the most recent report. Every year, the Iowa DNR does a report on greenhouse gases, greenhouse gas inventory, overall, and I just checked the numbers again, overall, Iowa accounts for 2% of all greenhouse gas production in the United States, but we only represent a little less than 1% of the nation's population. So the, on a per capita basis, we generate as twice as much greenhouse gases as other states, probably because we have a lot of driving in the state because we're spread out, but agriculture uses a lot, not only in the production of food, but also the processing of food, as well as the manufacture of fertilizer.
I don't want to run out of time to talk about some of the solutions that you see. So we're doing a very shallow dip into these topics right now. You go into them much more in depth in your book. But I do also want to talk about the racial history of Iowa. And I know that we do tend to celebrate some of our more progressive moments in our state. And we had a conversation about that just last week here on Talk of Iowa. Some of the things that really stand out in Iowa history about racial equity, about the fact that we were the first state in the union to desegregate public schools. However, we are a very white state, and you point out that that was largely by design.
Yes, yeah, exactly. And clearly, you know, part of that design was to, force the relocation of Native Americans from the state, you know, almost entirely. As you just indicated, there's sort of good stories and bad stories. The bad stories are that Native Americans were quite a bit were removed from the state, you know, but the Meskwaki, who were so tenacious, just didn't want to leave. And some didn't leave and some came back. And they were able to convince some people in the 1850s to allow them to buy land, the state legislature, that is, buy land in the state of Iowa in Tama County. And then they grew that from 80 acres to 8,000 acres. And they have a casino there that up until the COVID crisis, as I understand it, was doing very well. And the same is true with regard to African Americans. We had some horrendous laws on the books. Certainly one that basically said that was passed in the early 1850s that African Americans weren't allowed to live in the state of Iowa. That was later revoked during the Civil War. So you had pioneering court cases like the one that permitted desegregation of schools in the late 1860s. In part, that was because you had a very active black community, African-American community. Alexander Clark, as you well know, and Muscatine was a major force in that area, certainly in the case of school desegregation.
So the legacy of those early laws remain in Iowa, but we are an increasingly diverse state. We have, many people coming in from other countries, many people coming in from other parts of the state, drawn here by agriculture. What do you see as the main problem in Iowa in this moment when it comes to racial equality? What are our greatest challenges?
Well, I think our greatest challenge is also our greatest opportunity. The fact is that the growth, we are a slow growing state. We have been for a long time, really since 1900. There is, minuscule growth in the white population. The growth that we do have is in the Asian, African American, Native American, and Hispanic communities. But the kind of work, the kind of opportunities these populations have are very limited. They're very constrained. If these people are these new residents are the future of the state of Iowa, and to some extent we've done a good job of this. There are programs at the University of Iowa that try to enable people from communities like Columbus Junction or Storm Lake to come to the University of Iowa and get a degree. But there's not enough of that. We should be nurturing these populations, the people in these populations, better than we are. I know we've done interviews; they're not reported in the book, but we've done interviews of both Latinx and Burmese residents in Columbus Junction. And when you talk to them, the value that they of the communities that they live in, the support they feel in those communities, these people are loyal Iowans. But they need to have more opportunities than working in a meatpacking plant, for example. If the children, at least, of these people who have come here recently are going to want to stay and contribute to the community. So we should be doing more to accelerate their education and their engagement in the broader economy.
Well, and I mentioned earlier the fact that we have a graying population in the state of Iowa. The children of migrants or immigrants, those young people, that is the largest growing or the fastest growing portion of our population in the state. So that's an incredibly important part of our future if we want to have young people to drive this economy, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. They are the key. And I just don't, I think at some certain periods of time, this has been recognized. I think Governor Robert Ray recognized this in the 1970s. But I think more recently, we haven't heard that at all. And part of this, of course, is that the federal response has been to eliminate, practically to zero, the number of refugees that are able to come anywhere in the United States, let alone Iowa.
Let's talk about some of the main points that you make in the book, your thoughts, your opinions about how we can move forward in what you see as a healthier, more sustainable way. And one of those is supporting and growing the middle class. Just briefly, what are some of the things that you think Iowa needs to invest in?
Well, this sounds really self-serving, but I think we need to obviously continue to invest in higher education and increase the investment in higher education. That, as we just said, is a real key. We need to raise the minimum wage. We are way behind many, many other states at what it currently is, and we need to raise it. You can get into conversation about where that should go, $15 an hour or something like that, but it should be much higher than it is right now. So those are certainly two things. I think the other area is that we need to, and this is going to get sort of political, but the efforts to severely limit, if not destroy, public labor unions, teachers unions, for example, or other public unions in the state of Iowa, graduate students at the University of Iowa, another example of that, has made it much harder for these organizations to bargain on a variety of issues. In fact, they can't bargain on the variety of issues that they used to be able to bargain. Again, Iowa in the 70s was very enterprising, very creative, I should say, in passing laws that gave teachers unions a great degree of power. And as some people have pointed out, especially our small towns, and we find this when we go to small towns with our students, the middle class in some respects are the teachers. And if you can get the teachers to stay to contribute to the community, it makes a world of difference. But if they're struggling because they can't get a pay raise or their benefits are not as good as they should be, you're just hurting small towns and small communities in the state. I mean, communities like Des Moines will probably continue to thrive, but the smaller places that don't have really benefits for middle-class people to live there and opportunities for them to live there. The teachers are an important part of that.
You write a lot about restoring water quality and increasing our planning for climate change. And that's something that you feel is very important. And you also don't believe that it has to come at the cost of our agricultural economy.
No, I don't think so. There is a cost. Clearly, under the state's nutrient reduction strategy, one of the options that is laid out, they don't call them recommendations, but options, is planting of cover crops extensively across the state. I think the number is 60% of all corn and soybean land. That's a lot of you would notice that in the spring if there were that many 60% cover crops. That's going to require financial incentives. And there are limited financial incentives, but they are very limited. So the result is that, currently across the state, there are only 2.5 or 3% of agricultural land that has cover crops in the wintertime. And if we're going to get to 60%, or if we're going to expect farmers to invest in bioreactors, that use wood chips to filter out the nitrates. Even the state's reporting says they need many, many, many more of those. That's going to cost money. So we need to pay farmers to do those kinds of things. Expecting it to be done voluntarily is going to take forever. I'm not saying it's not going to happen. It's just going to take too long. But I think there's certain expectations of agriculture as well. I mean, Minnesota has a buffer law that requires, I can't remember how many feet it is, 30 or 40 feet of buffer, so that there's vegetation along our rivers and streams. That vegetation will help filter out the nitrates that would otherwise go into those rivers and streams. That has been resisted in the state of Iowa. It's been, you know, I think there's like 99% compliance in Minnesota. So I think it's going to, just like a lot of things, it's a combination of a carrot and a stick. And I hate to use the word stick, but the carrot would be the financial incentives to pay farmers to do cover cropping, create wetlands. And then secondly, would be some expectations that farms would not go all the way to the edge of the rivers and streams. We're doing some work in Manchester, Iowa, not that far from Iowa City, and that's, they have problems with flooding in Manchester. I didn't realize that, but and part of that is attributable to the fact that farmers in the area are planting so close to the rivers and streams that feed into the city, and so the result is that waters that would otherwise be absorbed on the edges of these rivers and streams now flow into the city of Manchester, right, and they have a significant flooding problem.
Well, Chuck, we are out of time, but so much food for thought and a great historic education in your book as well. Thank you for talking with me today.
Oh, glad to do it. One correction. We're now the School of Planning and Public Affairs.
All right.
We changed our name in June. Thanks.
All right. It's Green, Fair, and Prosperous by Charles Connerly. This is Talk of Iowa.